Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next to number 881105, Curtis Guidry versus Sheet Metal Workers National Pension Fund. Mr. Silverman, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. In the district court, Curtis Guidry stipulated that his former employer, the union, was entitled to a judgment in the amount of $275,000 because of theft by Mr. Guidry from his union employer. He, however, opposed any taking of his three separate pension funds based on the anti-alienation clause in the Employee Retirement Security Income Act of 1974, which is also known as ERISA. The district court imposed the constructive trust, indicating that it was creating only a narrow exception for Mr. Guidry and in favor of the union to redress the theft of union employer funds. The Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed, choosing between conflicting circuits, and chose to follow that line of cases that say that federal courts have inherent equitable common law powers to create exceptions to a congressional enactment. The Tenth Circuit also recognized on the alternative argument of Mr. Guidry that a constructive trust was a garnishment within the Consumer Credit Protection Act, which meant that he would be entitled to 75% as an exemption. However, the Tenth Circuit held that Mr. Guidry failed to preserve that right. Today, I will make three major arguments. The first is that Congress created the anti-alienation clause in ERISA with its own three narrow exceptions, none of which are applicable here. Under separation of powers, it is Congress, not the courts, that should make any changes to ERISA. Second, the creation of a special exemption for the union based on federal labor law would effectively gut the anti-alienation clause because any other judgment creditor of a federal cause of action would also say that its judgment was claimed to be impaired by the anti-alienation clause. Lastly, in the event that you find that the constructive trust was properly imposed, Mr. Guidry is entitled to at least 75% of his pension under the Consumer Credit Protection Act because a constructive trust clearly fits within the definition of garnishment.
Why do you say at least?
Why do I say at least?
Yes.
I should say 75%. There is no quantification. It's exactly that figure.
I thought I'd missed something. Okay.
No. As to the...
You didn't mean entitled to at least. You meant at least entitled to.
What I'm actually arguing is that he's entitled under the ERISA to 100%. So I'm arguing in the alternative that if you don't accept the first argument of 100, then he deserves 75%. As to the first argument, after almost a decade of study, Congress passed ERISA. This court has repeatedly called ERISA a comprehensive and reticulated statute. In fact, it has six subtitles. It has over 150 subsections, not counting other intricate sections. Among one of the interrelated provisions is the anti-alienation clause in section 1056D, which is clear-cut and straightforward. The concept of anti-alienation is not new to federal law and ERISA. Strong anti-alienation clauses have predated ERISA, such as in the Civil Service Retirement Act, the Social Security Act, the Railroad Retirement Act, and others. Congress has shown that it can create its own exceptions to ERISA by initially in the first act legislating two narrow exceptions and then in 1984 legislating a third, none of which are claimed to be applicable here. In enacting an anti-alienation clause, Congress chose between competing social principles. In enacting the clause, Congress decided that no matter how deserving a judgment creditor or how egregious an action of a judgment debtor was, that pension funds could not be touched. This is not unusual either, because both state and federal legislatures historically have provided exemption laws. Take the homestead exemption, which has been historical. Take the tools of the trade exemption. A pension is a tool of the trade of a retired person.
Mr. Silverman, can federal taxes be taken out of his share of the pension fund?
Under a special federal statute in the IRS, yes.
The Tenth Circuit assumed that the embezzlement of funds was from the pension fund itself.
Correct.
The Solicitor General says that isn't so, that the embezzlement was only of the union's funds.
That has been a misinterpreted fact, and we say the same thing. In fact, the action, there were competing claims in the district court, and in fact, Mr. Guidry was only fiduciary of one of the three plans, the Local 9 plan. He wasn't a fiduciary of the two national pension plans. As to that one plan, there was a state court action. He settled it before this instant case, and there was a release given to him, and the pension resumed. So he basically upheld his anti-alienation rights in that state court action. The union then started a separate action, brought in the pension funds. They came in different ways below.
Did the respondent raise this argument based on the Lamerda provision in the lower courts?
Not exactly. It was raised by the district judge. When he went and said in pare materia to create a narrow exception, he did cite the LMRDA and said, I think it's in pare materia. And as we've argued, in pare materia means statutes of the same subject matter. If you have to get to judicial construction, we would argue that the same subject matter of anti-alienation is anti-alienation, and those are found in the civil service and in other federal acts which have mandated exemption. So we think LMRDA talks about a substantive right, perhaps, whereas there's another substantive right in ERISA, namely an exemption. But you can still get your judgment. You just can't collect it against the pensions.
Are the narrow exceptions to the anti-alienation provision to which you refer, are they contained in ERISA?
Correct.
So we don't have to look outside of ERISA to decide what is a provision that prohibits assignment or alienation?
Correct. The first two were that you could voluntarily and revocably assign 10% of your benefits. The second in the initial legislation was if you borrowed from the plan, you could secure it with your benefits. And then in 84, Congress allowed the Quadro Qualified Domestic Relations Order to further the purpose of the act, so that divorced people, divorced spouses and children were also included within the rights of ERISA. So Congress has clearly thought about it, and this court has cautioned in other cases of ERISA against assuming that Congress unintentionally omitted something. That was in Massachusetts Mutual versus Russell. There was a caution of this court to assume that there's an additional remedy within this very complex interrelated statute. I today represent, as I had mentioned earlier, we view the pension as an exemption similar to the tool of the trade, because in essence, this is how the pensioner supports his family. And his family is often innocent of any wrongdoing in any event. And of course, the whole point of a pension fund is not only to provide for the pensioner, but for the dependents. Now, I do represent Mr. Guidry, who did seek to enforce his rights. In asserting his rights, I do not seek nor do I need to rehabilitate Mr. Guidry. He was convicted. He served a maximally imposed not only fine but criminal sentence. And today at 67, he is simply seeking a legal right than anyone else who is a judgment debtor has under the laws, whether under the homestead exemption, the tools of the trade, or the medical.
May I just ask at that point, do you agree that he violated the LMRDA statute? In I'm interested in the argument that your respondent makes that the Tenth Circuit didn't really rely on, that this is the relief under that statute.
Not under 501B, because they never brought a 501B argument, so it's for the first time that they say, wouldn't we fit within 501B? 501B says the court should give other appropriate relief. It is a broad general statement, and it cannot, in a view of construction, overcome a specific enactment. They got their relief. They got their judgment. They're frustrated like every other judgment creditor that they can't.
I understand your statutory argument. Supposing before ERISA was enacted, you had a trust of this kind administered by in this way, and a fiduciary of the trust violated the LMRDA statute, and there were spendthrift provisions in the trust which would normally be enforceable as a matter of state law. Would you not agree that in enforcing the federal statute that the federal judge could order relief that overcame the state law obstacle?
Respectfully, I do not. That's the very issue in United Mine Workers versus Tony Boyle, where it was pre-ERISA, and the argument was made that Mr. Boyle's conduct was reprehensible, and the court said it's reprehensible. The next argument was made, well, there's this federal labor policy in the LMRDA. And there, the court ruled that LMRDA cannot overcome a lawyer-drawn spendthrift clause. My argument is, if it can't overcome a lawyer-drawn spendthrift clause, how can it overcome a congressionally drawn spendthrift clause? I'm calling it a spendthrift clause.
Right. No, that's right. No, it would seem to follow if it could not overcome. Well, I wasn't aware of that case. Is that a circuit court case?
Yes, it's a circuit court case.
If that case is right, your argument would follow.
Well, it's a D.C. Circuit Court case. I can't appeal to it.
What circuit is it from?
Well, it's we think it is a proper ruling, and even if it isn't, the end result of, let's say you gave them.
You said it's D.C. Circuit, isn't it?
Yes.
There
you are.
Let's assume, and again, right, it's our argument, you can't come to this court for the first time and say, I wish I would have brought a 501B case. But let's give them that and say they bring it. If they got a judgment, it would still be for, it's a derivative suit that comes through a union member. And again, we claim they can't bring it because the union always already brought a suit. But let's say they bring it. They get a judgment. It's the same judgment they have here for defalcation against an employer, not against a union, and so you have the same bar. It all comes out the same. It's a judgment, though derivative in that instance. And I do want to emphasize that the facts of this case seem to get a bit twisted, that here we have a man who did steal from his employer union, but not the pension funds. His criminal conviction was for theft from the union. This civil judgment is for theft from the union. They did say otherwise. I raised it in my petition for rehearing, but it was not granted. But it wouldn't change the case at all,
right,
if they decided differently, because they followed St. Paul Fire and Marine versus Cox, which is an employer embezzlement case, which says federal courts have broad equitable powers, and we want to use it here. In fact, the majority of these cases that are in dispute are all employer embezzlement cases. So that seems to be the context in which it arises. So it is an error, and we feel we have to point it out, but it wouldn't change the result from the rationale of the Tenth Circuit. The district court, in imposing the constructive trust and creating what it called a narrow exception, had to rule in an inconsistent manner. We have two clauses that came into play in the district court, the non-forfeiture clause and the anti-alienation clause. The district court followed those restrictive cases, saying let Congress decide on the non-forfeiture issue. The pensions were seeking to deprive him of a pension. Mr. Guidry was seeking to get his pension, and the unions were saying, give him his pension, but give it to me. So we had three competing interests in the district court, and the district court said, I'm going to follow those restrictive cases. I'm not going to create an exception on the non-anti-alienation clause But then the court, inconsistently, to perhaps fill a social purpose that it saw or to do what it saw as good, it created this so-called narrow exception. And as we all know, good lawyers will use this narrow exception to create a greater crack in the door than we have now. There is. There's a Treasury regulation that we believe is legislative in nature versus interpretive.
Is it right on this?
Right on.
So, and did you call that to the attention of?
Yes, we did. And the reg is section 1.401, little a, 13, little b, 1. And it clearly says that a trust is not.
Where are you reading from in your brief?
Page 3 of my brief, I put it as statutes and regulations involved. Of course, that comes up under the Treasury context because one of the points of the anti-alienation clause is it appears not only in the Treasury law, an amendment to the IRS, but it also appears under the labor portion.
Regulations really just say what the statute does in about twice as many words, don't they?
You might say it, but at least for our purposes, it goes ahead and says there that in the parens, either at law or in equity, cannot be alienated or subject to attachment, garnishment, levy, and execution. And I know we could all make distinctions between those remedies, but it's like some cases say we're doing a constructive garnishment. Others say we're doing a constructive trust. Others say we're doing equity. It comes out that he doesn't have his pension, and he deserves his pension.
That provision merely is something that has to be included in order to meet the tax requirements.
Well,
it merely requires that that clause be in the instrument. It doesn't really say anything about the enforceability of the clause in a situation like this, does it?
Well, it appears the Treasury regulation was given power by the Congress to interpret it not only for the Labor Department but for the Treasury Department. There's a separate provision in ERISA. What you're reading, as you'll see in page 3, there is almost an identical provision in the IRS code and in the ERISA. And what we have here is that it was just decided that labor would not give duplicitous regulations. As to...
Yes, but I still think it's... Maybe I misread it, but all it says is that the trust instrument must contain such a provision.
Well, and everyone wants their trust to be protected under federal law from taxes or from initial.
Right, but I'm not sure that it adds anything to the fact that, I mean, it doesn't really answer the question. When a trust instrument has that kind of a provision, is it subject to having an exception such as was imposed in this case?
Absolutely not. Congress, the Treasury reg says we won't qualify a plan tax-wise
right. Unless
you have the provision. So if they didn't have it, they'd lose their tax, and you can say, so what? But ERISA itself says something in addition. It says plan benefits shall not be alienated, which is about the same thing, I agree, but it
clear- Well, I agree with you. I understand your statutory argument, but all I'm saying is I'm not sure the regulation really adds any force to your statutory argument. That's really what I'm saying.
All right. I wanted to point out as an argument under...
You might say that it does indicate at least the Treasury's interpretation of what alienation would consist of.
Garnishment.
That it would consist of garnishment and either at law and assignment either at law or in equity and so forth.
Well, the reason I didn't argue it strongly is because my principal argument is plain meaning, and I didn't need to go and say, but look at the Treasury regulation, that supports my argument. Perhaps I should have, but since I felt it was plain and we didn't really get that argument back at us, the argument we got back at us is we should have brought another lawsuit against you under the LMRDA. We're not going to support the Tenth Circuit, and you should lose. I would point out the argument that under the saving clause, if you take it that the saving clause somehow impairs an LMRDA judgment under Section 501B that they never got, if you argue that, then you'd argue that a judgment under the Securities Exchange Act of 34, the Fair Labor Standards Act, would also be impaired by the anti-alienation clause, you'd end up with any federal cause of action judgment creditor going right through the anti-alienation clause, which could not have been the intention. As to the last argument, in the event the court does uphold the constructive trust, we have made the alternative argument that under the Consumer Credit Protection Act, he is entitled to a 75% exemption. The union employer in its brief concedes, as it does on the constructive trust theory, that it's not seeking to uphold the rationale of the Tenth Circuit. That rationale was that Mr. Guidry failed to claim the exemption by filing an objection form. As the case was set up, they garnished before they got the constructive trust. The pensions denied they owed any sums because, as I had told you earlier, they wanted it forfeited. So they wrote zero. Under Colorado law, you have to calculate 75% the garnishee. Well, the garnishee, because it's mathematically impossible, did not calculate 75% of zero. Therefore, Mr. Guidry did not have, it wasn't ripe for him to object. The union's basic argument is, well, we need to go back to when it all happened in the beginning, and in whatever they argue, they can't get around the fact that their cause of action in the district court invoked the equity arm of the court. It said it was an equitable remedy. In their brief, they admit a constructive trust is an equitable remedy. And earnings under CCPA include pensions, and you have to give a 75% exemption at the very least in terms of use of the CCPA. A decision against Mr. Guidry, though satisfying for the particular moment and this particular union, would not be a step forward for the vast number of American workers who participate in pension funds, whether they're union members or not. ERISA's anti-alienation clause protects not only workers, but its often innocent spouses and dependents. Anti-alienation is a clear federal policy expressed not only in ERISA, but in other acts. Congress created the anti-alienation clause. If it is to be changed, Congress, not the court, should weigh, deliberate, and decide. Thank you. I would like to reserve my balance.
Thank you, Mr. Silverman. Mr. Goldhammer, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, what we have before us here is a case that the LMRDA was exactly designed to cover. And the LMRDA has been in this case from the very beginning. The LMRDA was the basis of the district court's opinion in this case. Opposing counsel quarrels with the district court's use of the term in pari materia. But what we have here is a case where you have
You sought recovery under LMRDA?
That's correct, Your Honor. We brought a complaint in the district court for the District of Colorado in which we alleged jurisdiction under Section 501B of the LMRDA. The first claim for relief, by the way, that's on page 29 of the joint appendix. Paragraph number one of the complaint alleges jurisdiction under Section 501B. So I don't know where opposing counsel gets the idea that this is not a 501B case or that we never alleged 501B. Then the first claim for relief in the complaint alleges breach of fiduciary duties under Section 501 of ERISA, of the LMRDA, the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, which is 29 United States Code Section 501. The LMRDA has been in this case from day one. It was the basis of the district court's opinion. It's been here all along. It is the essence of this case. And the fact that the Tenth Circuit did not, I take chief responsibility for not being persuasive enough in my arguments to the Tenth Circuit for them to rely upon it.
I mean, your judgment, you defend their opinion?
Well, I defend the result of their opinion.
Yes, yes. But
there are two major aspects of it that I have problems with. One of the problems...
Well, I don't, but you don't, you're not here defending that rationale.
I'm not really defending that rationale.
You're presenting another ground for affirmance.
I am presenting another more persuasive ground for affirmance, in some respects at least, in many respects at least. This is the type of case that was exactly designed to be covered under the LMRDA.
May I just ask you a question about the LMRDA? There were three trusts involved, and is it correct that he was a fiduciary of only one of the three?
There were actually, yes, that's true, three pension trusts and a welfare trust that he stole some money from. He was a trustee out of two out of the four.
And as to the two of which he was not a trustee, did you assert an LMRDA claim as to those?
Well, the LMRDA claim doesn't assert stealing in particular from pension funds. It asserts stealing from unions.
A violation of his duties as a union officer, not as a fiduciary.
Exactly. Exactly. Section 501 specifically creates fiduciary duties for union officers.
You are not claiming, you are not in this argument at least, you are not relying on a claim that a breach of his fiduciary obligations as a trustee of two of the four funds is what justifies this relief.
Well, we're in a sense relying on both, but primarily, we are relying on the fact that he breached his fiduciary duties to the union.
And is it correct that insofar as you sought relief from the fund of which he was a trustee, whether it's one or two, that claim has been satisfied?
No. That claim has... What happened here was that...
It would be a lot easier for me if I got a yes or no.
Yeah. And...
That it had been satisfied. I want to be sure I'm not misled.
Okay. Insofar as that trust fund claims against him, he has been released by that trust fund for any liability to that trust fund.
All right. Thank you.
And the facts of this case are very complicated, and the reason why they're complicated is because Mr. Guidry made them complicated. The way in which he stole money was very complicated.
No, I understand, but the two things that are do characterize the claims that at least the main portion of what remains is, one, he was an officer of the union, and the union was his employer. I mean, it's both that he breached duties that he owed under the statute, and secondly, his status as an employee of the union makes it fit within some of these other cases.
The fact that he was an employee of the union makes no difference in this case. The LMRDA imposes...
It doesn't for the LMRDA, but I'm talking about some of the other circuit court decisions have said, in effect, that embezzlement from an employee, when that happens, when you embezzle from an employer, you can get relief against the ERISA fund.
Right, and we don't rely on those cases either. We don't rely on the Cox case.
Okay?
We rely on the fact that he was a union officer. Mr. Guidry, and in fact, in many unions, the rank and filers are the officers of the union. They aren't employed by the union in any sense. And that has nothing to do with this case. The fact that Mr. Guidry was employed by the union really has no major part in this case. The fact that he was a union officer is the key thing.
Well, the funds we're talking about now were funds taken from the union, not the pension fund. For purposes of our discussion.
For purposes of our discussion, yes. And I'm giving you a yes answer to that question, just so you don't misunderstand me. But it's also important for you to understand that Mr. Guidry's schemes of embezzlement involved these pension funds very directly and to a very great degree. And this is the way he did it. Money passed between the pension funds and the union. The reason for that is that the union performed clerical services for the pension funds. And Mr. Guidry would steal them while they were in transit. And then nobody could figure out who he stole the money from. And I'm terribly sorry that I have to give you evasive or ambiguous answers about where the money was stolen from. What?
You didn't. You said yes.
Yeah. But what's going on here is that Mr. Guidry has created these complexities, and now he relies on these complexities in order to thwart the union's attempt to get its money back.
Has the union gotten any of its money back?
No. Not one penny, even though Mr. Guidry has indicated that
he's
very sorry.
How much is missing?
Well, we, our judgment is for $275,000. The audit that was done in 1981 by Arthur Young and Company showed that practically $1 million, $998,000 and change, was missing from the union at that time. And what was happening is that during the period, at least we know, from early 1970 up through September of 1981, Mr. Guidry was stealing from the union on a month-by-month-by-month basis, every single month. In the criminal case, it was documented in the prosecutor's statement that between April of 77 and the end of September of 81, Mr. Guidry stole on 75 separate occasions. This is the kind of... So what we have here is an LMRDA case, and it's also a state law case. You'll notice in the complaint that we also went ahead and claimed four claims for relief under state law. So you might ask the question, what was the Congress doing in enacting the LMRDA if the types of conduct which they were trying to proscribe in the LMRDA was also covered under state law? In Colorado, we have laws against embezzlement and theft and conversion, and all of those are pled in the complaint. So what was going on here is that union officers in the 1950s and before that, the Jimmy Hoffas, the Dave Becks, the people who are the most ignominious names in labor history, were stealing from unions and not paying the money back. And they found a way under state law to avoid paying money back. And what the LMRDA is all about is you got to pay it back. It's a restitutionary statute. What it adds to state law is you got to pay it back. It's a federal law, first of all. It gives the federal powers and the federal authorities...
That's federal enforcement to state law. That's a big thing right there.
Yes. Adds federal...
Even without anything else, it'd be worth it.
That's right. But it went further. It incorporated state fiduciary laws in Section 501A, which means fiduciary means equitable remedies. What you're talking about here is broadening the scope of remedies. Senator Goldwater.
Excuse me, so does employer-employee relationship involve fiduciary, but you don't want to rely on those cases, and I think why you don't is because it's clear that there's no less reason for applying those cases and that relationship than there is to apply the union the union officer relationship.
Well, there are some employer-employee relations are fiduciary relations, and some may not be, but
what I'm worried about, I mean, my point is, I'm worried about making a big hole in the provision that these trust funds retirement funds are not obtainable by judgment creditors.
Absolutely. And we're worried about the same thing, and that's why we're not relying on those cases.
You're worried that I'm worried. That's what you're worried about.
Exactly. I somehow had a feeling you'd be worried. And so what we did here was we say, you know, this is an LMRDA case, first of all. And second of all, you've got Section 514D of ERISA, which says that although ERISA preempts, actually in 514A, it says ERISA preempts state law, it says that ERISA shall not impair, supersede, modify, amend, do anything to. It doesn't say that. But the overall picture here is not to affect other federal laws. And that's the important point about federalizing the fiduciary relationship in the LMRDA. So what does the other side do with 514D? They don't mention it. But there is also the argument that if you apply 514D in this case, then you open up the floodgates again, because then every other federal judgment will be taken in by this. And anybody who has a federal judgment can overcome the anti-alienation provision. Wrong. Not every federal judgment is based upon a statute like the LMRDA. The LMRDA is remedies, remedies, remedies. That's what it's all about.
Well, but certainly you can say the same thing about the Securities Act, about some other acts. They have elaborate provisions for remedy.
Well, to the extent that they were exclusively created for the purpose, I must confess, Your Honor, that my malpractice insurance doesn't cover securities law. And therefore, I know what I know about it, you put in a thimble. But to the extent that those... just a minute.
Yeah. Wait until I finish my question.
Absolutely.
You're defending against an argument that if we accept your position here, judgments under other federal laws would be equally subject to overriding the garnishment. So surely you're obligated to make some sort of a response.
And my response is that that the court should approach those subjects on a case-by-case basis. I accept your characterization of the securities laws because I know nothing about it, but I accept your characterization. And to the extent that the securities laws were created as a remedial supplement to already existing state laws to cover ground that was already covered by state law, then I would argue that there would be an exception for the securities laws as well. Have I answered your question?
It seems to me you've agreed there should be an exception for any federal statute that authorizes the judge to grant X, Y, and Z relief and any other appropriate relief.
Well, I...
Maybe RICO, the Sherman Act, all sorts of statutes.
I'm not going that far. I'm saying that what we have here is a case where there would be no reason for the statute's existence at all. What the other side seems to be saying is that this case is not...
No, that isn't true here because the statute, LMRDA, would at the very least authorize a judgment against your adversary. Maybe you couldn't collect it from this particular pool of assets. But you're not totally frustrating the purposes of the Lanham Griffin.
Well, in this case, there's no reason for the existence of Title V except for the fact that it broadens the remedial scope of the statute. We could have gotten the same judgment under four counts in the complaint stating state law.
Well, to say that it doesn't apply to your case is not to say that it has no purpose. I mean, that's a rather high standard to impose upon any law.
Well,
to say that it's a law that does nothing unless it helps your case. It helps a lot of other cases.
My case is the typical Landrum-Griffin case. If Landrum-Griffin was designed to cover anything, it was designed to cover stealing from labor unions, Title V.
But the typical case is the one in which the only assets remaining are the assets that are under this kind of an ERISA entitlement is
the typical case is where the defalcating union officer finds convenient ways to make his assets.
Well, but this is only one convenient way.
Yes, and it's the one we're dealing with here. It's probably the most convenient way.
Well, I don't know.
What about an embezzlement statute that says anytime you embezzle money from the federal government? You're in deep trouble, and there's a provision for recovering the money. You think the United States could attach these funds?
Judging by the United States' position with regard to taxes and the FDIC,
I know, but their position with respect to this getting to the pension fund is a little different.
So you're saying that if the federal government...
Oh, I'm asking you.
I know, but I want to make sure I understand your question.
All right.
And you're saying that if the federal government had an embezzlement statute,
which it does, and suppose it brings it wants to recover the money.
Mm-hmm.
And so it brings a suit to recover the money. Can they attach his benefits from a pension fund?
I.
After all, the only reason for the embezzlement statute is to prevent embezzling from the government.
Yeah, and
I don't know why if they can't recover, I don't know why a union should be able to.
Right, and what I would say to that is, if you apply Section 514D strictly, then the answer to that question would be yes, they could recover out of a spendthrift clause. These spendthrift clauses have not a totally clear history. The Boyle case, which is the D.C. Circuit case that we were talking about earlier, was a case in which it was a pre-ERISA case, but it was about a 1977 case covering events in the early 70s. And it was a case basically in which there was a voluntary spendthrift trust provision in one of these pension plans. that was voluntarily agreed to by the union that was now trying to get around it. And the court basically said, the district court in that case basically said, we're not going to let you get around it because you could have changed it at any time. You could have changed it. At that time, the major debate was whether spendthrift clauses covered any torts whatsoever. And so when Congress enacted ERISA, they brought the spendthrift trust provision into the federal arena. And at that time, they also enacted Section 514D. And they said that we're not going to impair any other federal law with this whole statute. And therefore, if the example that you give is consistent with the literal language of ERISA and with the statements made and with the entire purpose of ERISA. I would like to cover a couple of other points. One is that, I probably ought to go on and talk about the CCPA argument. Here again, we are faced with harmonizing the CCPA and the LMRDA. The remedy that the court chose in this case was the constructive trust, which is an equitable remedy. There's no doubt it's an equitable remedy. And what we were arguing under the CCPA is that the equitable remedy they chose, it authorizes the court to go back and look at what the source of the earnings was and to determine whether those earnings were obtained by fraud. In this case, Mr. Guidry's earnings were obtained by fraud. He engaged in a long series of fraudulent activities against the union, which were not disclosed. The contributions were made into the pension plans by him when they shouldn't have been made into the pension plans because he was committing fraud at the same time. He was, in effect, getting double compensation for his work at the union, and they were fraudulently obtained. What the opponent's position is on the CCPA is that the rather typical language in that statute, which prohibits any legal or equitable procedure to get at the earnings of a person, precludes the court from engaging in that kind of analysis. In other words, I guess what they're saying is that if you commit an outright theft of money and put it into a pension plan, that there's no way to get at that money anymore. And that is a radical position for the court to take. It is not...
Maybe Congress was radical.
Congress wasn't radical. The language of this statute is similar to the language of most anti-alienation provisions in various other statutes, and the common law is that with respect to homesteads, with respect to anti-alienations, the provisions in life insurance policies, that we're just not going to allow these little refuges for fraud. That the common law, that these equitable remedies were designed for the very purpose of voiding exemptions where that's necessary to avoid unjust enrichment.
What is the rule if there's a beneficiary of a spendthrift trust works for a bank, but he likes to steal, so he steals from the bank too, and the bank wants to get the money back? Can they break the spendthrift provision?
Well, the rule in the Cox case is that they can. That's the case in which
they
there is
can't
a split.
They cannot?
There's a split in the circuits on
well,
that.
Well, I know. Well, so you mean some people say the bank could break the spendthrift trust?
That's correct.
And others say not? What's the majority rule?
The 10th in this case and the 11th say, yes, you can. I believe the 2nd and the 6th say, no, you can't.
Mm-hmm. Apart from just going back to Justice White's question, at common law, before we had all these statutes, what would the answer have been in his hypothetical?
At common law, I think the majority view was that tort creditors were not covered by spendthrift trust provision, and therefore you could get at the money. That was the argument in the Boyle case. That was the argument that was being made in the Boyle case. And the court said, well, we're not going to get to that question as to whether tort causes of action are covered under spendthrift trust provisions, because you were the ones who made the spendthrift trust provision yourself, and you didn't provide any exception yourself. So that the law clearly was that if the spendthrift provision was defined by the agreement of the parties to the pension agreement.
Of course, the Boyle case is not a typical common law case. That's also had the Landrum Griffith involved and so forth. I was really asking about, say, in the 19th century, the old cases on just breaking spendthrift trust. And you say the general rule was that a tort judgment creditor could invade the trust, notwithstanding the spendthrift.
Right.
That's your understanding.
And Scott on trust describes the reason for that. He says that a person who makes a contract with another person has the opportunity to investigate that person's credit rating and determine whether he's going to have to get at pensions in order to satisfy his judgment. Whereas a person who's standing in front of a vehicle who happens to get knocked down by a careless driver doesn't have that choice, and that therefore he makes a strong argument that tort creditors at common law should never have been precluded from getting at pensions.
Professor Scott making the argument that they should never have been subjected, is that the same as saying that was the law at common law?
It's my understanding that is the common law.
Okay, thank you.
There is no question that if Mr. Guidry is able to do what he has set out to do in this case, that it would cause great impairment to Landrum Griffin. And it would cause great impairment also to ERISA itself. There is a case which the government was a party in called Crawford versus La Boucherie Bernard, which establishes yet another exception to the anti-alienation provision, one where the money is actually stolen from the trust fund itself. There are several other exceptions that have been recognized by the court for the anti-alienation provision. We cite them in the brief. One is bankruptcy and the question of whether the pension fund becomes a part of the bankrupt's estate. There is a case called FDIC versus Calhoun and another one in the Tenth Circuit called FDIC versus Farha, in which the FDIC has contended that when they come in and take over a bank, that they can invade the pension funds of the president of the bank who may owe money to the bank in order to satisfy that debt. And there have been a number of exceptions at common law. So the only place to look for these exceptions is not ERISA itself. In fact, before ERISA was amended to expressly authorize exceptions for domestic relations orders, the courts had already implied an exception. What Mr. Guidry did here in large measure was to steal money from a union, to steal some money from the pension fund and from a welfare fund. And by the way, the fact that he stole money from those two entities is in the record by virtue of the fact that Mr. Guidry himself entered into the record a settlement agreement that he made. And in that settlement agreement, he confessed to a judgment of $205,000 against the two local funds, the welfare fund and the pension fund, but he was left off the hook for only $50,000. But we are concerned about the fact that this kind of activity is documented in labor history, the very kind of activity that Mr. Guidry engaged in. In the legislative history of Landrum Griffin, Dave Beck is reputed to have stolen $400,000, and now that they're unable to get the money back because he is engaged in some kind of subterfuge to hide the money away or do whatever. And that it will also damage ERISA itself, because ERISA is really designed to protect pensioners. And if Mr. Guidry can get away from stealing money in transit or from stealing money directly from these trust funds and making it so complicated that we can't tell who he stole it from, then that will occur again. And we are concerned about that in particular. We are also concerned about the individuals who are the victims of these thefts.
your opposition's position is that it wouldn't make any difference whether he stole it from a pension fund or anyplace else.
Well, I'm not completely clear about that. The Crawford case, at least the amicus in this case, the Solicitor General, has taken the position, taken the position that he supports the rule in the Crawford case.
Yes.
And so I'm not completely clear that what my opponent's position would be on that. I think it is important to point out that unions are vulnerable to these kinds of thefts because while the members of Local 9 of the Sheet Metal Workers Union are tremendous sheet metal workers, they are of necessity people who work with their hands and are unsophisticated about financial affairs, and that they will lose if ERISA is not upheld, the purposes of ERISA is not upheld to promote fiduciary and honest conduct, and also if the LMRDA if this loophole is created in the LMRDA to allow union officers to put money away in pension funds while they know that money isn't really owed to them because they've been taking what...
Mr. Goldhammer, I take it as a creditor you can get money as it's paid out up to 75% of it. Is that right?
That we can get?
When the benefits are actually paid out on a monthly basis and in the hands of Mr. Guidry?
Mr. Guidry's position is that we can get nothing, Your Honor.
Even when they're paid out?
When they are in his hands?
Yes.
Uh-huh. If they are in a bank account, then I think the law is that we can get them. If they are in a brown bag or if they are in Switzerland where we can't get access to them, or if they are under Mr. Guidry's mattress and we don't know about it, then we can't get anything. And Mr. Guidry has shown himself quite competent.
Or with wherever the $900,000 he took is.
Well, the $900,000...
You don't know where that is, I guess.
Well, the $900,000, it's pretty well documented, was spent at gambling casinos.
Oh, really?
Establishments.
Just frittered it away.
Yes. He lost big. Actually, the union lost big. It was the union that was gambling, not Mr. Guidry. It's only the problem is that the union didn't know it.
I take it procedures to execute your judgment. I suppose you can haul him into court and ask him, find out what his assets are and things like that.
Sure.
And can you get an order to pay over to, as soon as he gets the money, can you get an order to having to pay it over?
There's a case in this court called Hisquerdo versus Hisquerdo, which said you can't do that. In that case, there was an anti-alienation provision.
Because that's just a runaround of the anti-alienation.
Yeah, that makes the anti-alienation provision meaningless.
Yes.
If you want to rule that we can do that, I'd be more than happy to accept that ruling, but you'd have to overrule Hisquerdo versus Hisquerdo.
Thank you, Mr. Silberman. Mr. Goldhammer?
I'm Mr. Goldhammer.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Goldhammer. Mr. Silberman, you have rebuttal.
I do. I would like to say, however, that I don't have any formal rebuttal, but would be glad to answer any questions.
What if the money had been stolen from the pension fund itself?
That would have been a different case. That's the Crawford case.
Yes.
And it would be, I think there, I can make an argument on either side. You're asking, and I am happy to make it, to, of course, discuss a case that isn't here because their judgment, as he admitted. But the argument that I would make as strict constructionist as to the policy is that the only way the Crawford Court allowed an offset, it called it an offset, between the plan and the individual as opposed to a third party, the employer. Even though the employer has related interests, under Section 1103, plan benefits can't inure to the benefit of the employer. But as to the Crawford instance, the Congress allowed the courts to create a common law remedial or equitable remedy for breach of fiduciary duty. There, you would have to confront the question of how far you take your case of Massachusetts Mutual versus Russell, where that same language about common law creation within ERISA, you did refuse to say that Congress left out a remedy. There was a claim for extra contractual damages, for punitive damages, and the court said, don't assume Congress left out something. What you have to confirm.
I think you've answered the question, Mr. Silverman. Thank you. The case is submitted.
Now adjourn until Monday next at 10 o'clock.